Live from the launching pad in Sedona, Arizona, this is the Progressive Technology Hour, and I'm your host, Dr. Houdini. I would like to welcome you to a truly unique talk show program that focuses on exotic technologies. What are exotic technologies? Well, this includes such areas as free energy, gravity, anti-gravity control, the study of the nature of time, and time travel. We'll explore not only the technology, but also the how-to part of the technology. So let's have some fun today and explore the world of exotic technologies. Folks, my special guest, returning guest, today is researcher Greg Volk. Greg Volk attended Stanford from 1979 to 1984 as an electrical engineer and also took the entire core undergraduate curriculum in physics. He did not complete his master's in signal processing, but did work in optical character recognition and CAD conversion. An entrepreneur at heart, chose not to go into physics or engineering as a career, but been a stockbroker and investor, real estate broker, mortgage broker, landlord, music arranger, composer, and business owner. Inspired by the work of David Bergman and Charles Lucas, Jr. of Common Sense Science, Volk has been actively researching the fundamental laws of physics since 2007 and has contributed substantially to the World Science Database. And Greg is putting on a conference that's coming up towards the end of June. Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bill.
Greg, let's get into this conference that you're putting on.
Okay, well, I'll start from the beginning, if that's all right.
Yes, start at the very beginning here.
As you mentioned, I haven't been at this as long as a lot of people. I know you've been at this for many, many years, although I have had a passing interest in physics for years, just as just kind of putzing around with things. I got very seriously interested a few years ago when I was introduced to the toroidal ring model of David Bergman and Charles Lucas, which their material is available at commonsensescience.org. And through that, I discovered an organization called the Natural Philosophy Alliance, and I found that there were a lot of people that were active in that who were authors and who were contributing really amazing ideas relating to just fundamental physics, all the way from relativity theory to quantum mechanics to obviously structures of fundamental particles in matter, and that interested me very, very much. I also became attracted to a lot of the people involved in what I might call the new energy or the Tesla people.
Right.
And what I found, what was surprising, really, was that there was not a lot of communication, not as much as there should be, between the people who are kind of involved in the pure physics and the people who are involved in the experimental side, the engineers and whoever they're trying to come out there and, you know, make technologies. There is a difference between pure science and technology, but the fact is that they both need each other. And I felt that, you know, there was a real lack of that. So getting back to the Natural Philosophy Alliance, I attended the conference 2 years ago, which was at that time in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And it was, on the one hand, I went because there were so many people whose work I had read and I wanted to meet them. But also I was surprised at how few people there were there. I thought, wow, these are the leading people in alternative science today. Where is everybody, you know? So I got involved in helping to create the database. We talked about this last time with mm-hmm. David DeHilster, who's had this vision for many years. I did a lot of the contributions in terms of just putting in the content, whereas David has done a lot of the work as far as building the mechanics of the website. But as part of that, we have really a shared vision about creating greater communication among scientists, and especially bridging the gap, as it were, between experimentalists and technologists and scientists, and getting the two sides aware of each other a little more. And so we created that, and we've also been encouraging more participation in the in the conference, which we've been holding annually. This will be the 17th annual conference, so this will be my third that I've attended. Last year's attendance was double what it was the year before.
Really?
And this year's attendance will be more than that. So we're definitely growing and expanding the vision.
Now, let me ask you this. Has the conference always been in Long Beach area, or does it move around?
No, as a matter of fact, well, let me give you a little history. The NPA was founded by a guy named John Chappelle. He's now deceased. He died in 2002. Mm-hmm. And he had a vision for, he really felt it was important, and he was right, that scientists, there are many, many scientists who have been working in isolation and developing their own theories,
right,
but really without much of a, not much of a support network, not much of a chance to just get together and chew the fat and see each other's works. There are, have always been scientific conferences, you know, inviting scientists to write papers and then make presentations on those papers. That's nothing new, but it wasn't available really. If you were so, you know, outside the mainstream, you didn't have the opportunity to do that unless you happen to get lucky, you know, and get your paper accepted somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a tremendous backlog of really quality work. I mean, I'm talking about thousands and thousands of papers that have been written, and they are comparable in every respect to the stuff that you'll find in mainstream periodicals, except they're obviously outside the paradigm, so they don't get published in those periodicals.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what we have this time. Right now we have about 110 abstracts, 80 of which have papers completed, and I'm very busy helping to edit those. I'm working with Dr. Cynthia Whitney, who is also the editor of a periodical called Galilean Electrodynamics.
Mm-hmm.
And we're editing these. It's going to be a professional quality. It should be comparable in every way to a mainstream publication of a proceedings for a scientific conference.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not turning papers away for reasons of being outside the box.
Right.
You know, we're insisting on quality. We want well-written papers. We want, we do have a peer review system, because those people that are involved, that are active on our database, can log in and actually critique each other's papers. It's
mm-hmm.
not a closed-door thing. It's open. We want, you know, we have to be civil with each other, because there are always disagreements, and that's okay. We want to encourage people to agree to disagree, because that's how science really needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going on right now, that process of getting the papers honed and everything. And every one of those papers, many of them are in absentia. They are written by authors, for example, all over the world. We've got people in Russia and people in China and people in India who are contributing to this. So it's not just the U.S., although most of the participants who will actually be physically there will be from the U.S. And we'll have roughly 70 presentations of various sorts throughout the conference, and it's going to be very full. What's really nice about it is, you know, I would encourage people who are not maybe kind of thinking they have an interest in science, but they're just, you know, get a little intimidated by the thought of going to a scientific conference.
Mm-hmm.
This would be a great place to come, because it's, you know, it's not that overwhelming. And you can understand an awful lot of what's going on if you're seriously interested in these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So,
now the participant here or the attendee can choose which. I would imagine that you're going to have multiple presenters going on.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, this would be the first year where we're going to have to do that. We've always kind of been a nice tight little family, and I regret.
Uh-huh.
That we're going to have to split into two groups this year, but
okay.
That's just the price you pay for growth, I guess. So,
So
we're going to do that for the first time ever.
Because I noticed you have a huge number of presenters here.
Yep.
Yeah. Now the listener can go to. Can you give out a link?
Yeah. The site is CONF17, which stands for conference, 17th conference. conf17.worldsci.org. So that site will get you to pretty much all the information about the conference. We're doing something new this year, and that is in the past we've had 5 days of just presentations, and then everybody goes home. This year we're only having 3 days of presentations. We have more presentations in less time, but we're adding a fourth day, which is what we call public day. And the public day is, of course, if you can only make it to one, that's the day we'd like to have you come. We're opening up to the public, obviously. We're going to try to have more hands-on. We've never done this before where we're having, you know, people come in and say, here's my experiment, and here's, you know, here's what it shows, mm-hmm. and here's what we can do with it, and that kind of thing. So, again, it's not really a technology thing, which is different than the Extraordinary Technology Conference. We're focusing just on the science. Here's an experiment that I did. Here's my results. We definitely encourage quantitative results, you know, as opposed to just, you know, a nifty little video. But and then we want to say, here's my theory of it. Of course, everybody has a theory. And but that's something new for us, and we're going to bring the public to come in and see some of that. In addition, on that day, we've got four what we call invited speakers, which are fairly well known people. I'll go ahead and list them. Ron Hatch is a world renowned expert in GPS systems, and he's going to basically be talking about the fact that GPS systems do not use Einsteinian's form of relativity. They use Newtonian mechanics.
Really?
And that's a big surprise to a lot of people. But, yeah.
Well, you know, let me stop you right there, Greg.
Okay,
you know,
sure.
I did some work in that, too. You know,
okay.
To calculate what that shift in frequency is.
Mm-hmm.
And I was stunned when I did the calculations using the mathematics that I developed. I nailed it perfectly.
Good for you.
Even slightly more accurate than what Einstein's general relativity calculated.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't want to get derailed onto a long diversion of that. But there's a lot of things right about Einsteinian relativity in terms of mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some major things that are wrong in terms of the basic philosophy and understanding behind it. And that can sometimes lead us down wrong paths. And so that's really difficult to separate the mathematics from the philosophy behind it. But we have to do that if we really want to make improvements on some of this understanding. I'll just give you a quick example is what I'm trying to talk about. When we talk about, you know, time dilation, a lot of times, you know, people do understand that the measurement of time, that the clocks actually do run slower on a GPS satellite than they do here on Earth. But mm-hmm. there is a reason, and it's a physical reason, and it has to do with the fact that the gravitational field is different here on the Earth than it is there. And
right.
it's not bidirectional. In other words, you know, according to the famous twin paradox, the one twin is traveling, he ages slower than the one that's not traveling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, viewed from the point of view of the one that's traveling, the other guy is traveling. Why isn't he aging faster? Do you follow what I'm saying? It's mm-hmm. asymmetric, and there is an asymmetry. In other words, the clock on the GPS satellite is moving slower. Okay, it isn't the time itself is moving slower. It's just that the cesium atom is oscillating at a slower rate for physical reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean that the clock on the Earth looks slower to the ship. It doesn't go both ways.
Right.
And so there is a right way. There is an absolute. It's never going to go slower than in an environment like the orbiting satellite, which experiences no external field.
Mm-hmm.
That's as slow as it'll ever go. No matter how fast you travel. So anyway, Ron will be talking about that. That's just one. Second speaker that we've invited is Dr. Michael McCoubrey, who appeared on 60 Minutes a year ago and talking about, well, we like to call it low energy nuclear reactions, but the popular notion is cold fusion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think his talk is called cold fusion is still hot or something like that. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact title, but anyway, so he'll be one of our invited speakers, and that's a whole other area. A third area, which probably you may not be familiar with, I don't know, is the issue of expanding Earth. There's a growing number of researchers who are coming to the conclusion that the Earth has been and is now expanding.
Right.
And one of the people, he's not really a scientist, but he's been on the forefront just in terms of promoting the idea, is Neil Adams. He's a cartoonist.
Right,
he's
right.
Been speaking.
No, I had him on my show.
Oh, okay. Well, then you know him. Okay,
yes.
that's a third and totally different idea,
mm-hmm.
and we've also asked the guy who I think has spent probably as many views on YouTube as anybody, and that's Bill Beatty,
oh, yeah.
Or Beatty, And he's going to be speaking also, and he's going to be presenting some of his cool experiments too. So
okay.
Those are our four mainline speakers, but we're going to have a whole lot more going on Saturday besides that. And anyway, and like I said, we'll have 70-some presentations going on from Wednesday through Friday. We're also, on Friday evening, we've scheduled something. This will be our second annual, what we call our Senyak Award. And some people may not know, a lot of people may not know who Senyak is. But first of all, let me just explain. What we decided was that there really needs to be an award to honor the great work that has gone before us and has been done in what you might call dissident or alternative or independent science.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to recognize those people. And so we think of it as the Nobel Prize of alternative physics. And we awarded three octogenarians last year, and we're going to be awarding three more this year. And the reason we chose the name Senyak is quite appropriate, I think. He was actually a contemporary of Einstein. And it could be argued that his work, which was experimental, was more significant than Einstein's work, which was theoretical and perhaps wrong in some sense. So Senyak did an experiment on a rotating platform showing that if a beam of light, while it's rotating, travels in one direction around the platform, and
yes,
it will actually create a fringe shift with the beam of light.
Well, you know, that experiment, yes, that experiment is very interesting.
Yeah,
because I had the gentleman that did that experiment in Germany.
He was French. Senyak was French.
Maybe
you're thinking of a different one.
Well, this experiment was done several months ago, last year.
Oh, you're thinking of Martin Gruznick.
Yes.
That's not the same thing. That's a different one. We could talk about that actually. There will be a guy named Norm Silliman who's going to be reproducing Gruznick's effect, or something very similar, and something that he did prior to Gruznick. That's a different effect. That's an effect due to the change with respect to the light beam travels the same path back and forth, but does it travel through a gravitational gradient or not.
Right.
And there's still some debate as to whether that's really caused by the gravitational gradient or whether it's actually just a shifting of the mechanical equipment.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to keep an open mind. I'm open to interpretations, and we're going to see the physical experiment with Norm Silliman. He'll be one of the demonstrators there on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
But to get back to the Senyak Award, Senyak's effect is a little different. In other words, the light beam actually encloses an area, if you will. If you think of it maybe on top of like a record player, it encloses a certain space going in both directions, and the amount of space that it encloses, the amount of area that it encloses, is proportional to the amount of fringe shift that you're going to notice. And that's been calculated, and it's actually been known since 1913. And what's ironic is that it does that you don't see it in the physics textbooks. I mean, it's I took physics, and it's just not there. I didn't find out about it until much later. And it really ought to be
right
up there with
effect.
Faraday. You know, I mean, it's important.
Well, it's a very subtle effect.
Well, yeah. You know, I think it's a significant effect. It can actually be derived directly from Faraday's law. However, we need to make sure that we're talking about Faraday's law from the proper reference frame. Let me just digress for just a minute here and say that Einstein's 1905 paper said that the effect of a pull of a magnet through a magnetic of a circuit through a magnetic field depended on the relative motion of the conductor to the magnet.
Okay.
That's what he said. And he based his theory, that's on page one, and he based his theory on that assumption. And the fact is that's not true. It is not the relative motion of the magnet to the conductor that counts. It's the relative motion of the conductor to the Earth, in other words, the reference frame that's establishing where it is. You can see this effect. Bill Beattie's going to have one where he calls it the high-speed maglev, where he actually rotates these copper bars, and he's able to levitate a magnet because the copper bars, then what happens is the electrons on the copper, the conductor, kind of slush around. That creates a magnetic field, and the magnetic field then creates an interaction with the magnet and lets it levitate. So I won't go into more detail than that, but essentially that's a fundamental misconception of Faraday's law. And there's a lot of background on it, but it goes back to the Lorentz transformation. And why do we even need the Lorentz transformation? There was a guy named Heinrich Hertz, who discovered the electromagnetic waves, who had a different approach. His approach was to say, let's take into account the reference frame as part of the change in time. Instead of partial derivatives, we need total time derivatives. That somehow, in other words, when you talk about the flow of a river, the river is always flowing with respect to the bank, regardless of whether you're running along with it or whether you're sitting on the bank.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to take into account, you know, how we're moving, as well as the effect that we see. And
okay.
Sometimes, at least in Faraday mechanics, we fail to do that. And so that's some challenges. There'll be some experiments there to show what I'm talking about. Francisco Mueller is going to be displaying his experiment to show that it's the movement of the conductor and that counts, not the movement of the magnet or the relative movement of the two. So anyway, very significant stuff. I don't know. I could go on all day. I could tell you about all 70 presentations.
Let's go back to this Neil Adams work.
Okay.
You know, the expanding Earth hypothesis.
Yep.
Which I think is more of a theory. You know, where do you draw the line
between theory and hypothesis? It seems to have a lot more evidence.
Well, you know, he does a really good animation showing how all the continents fit together.
Yep.
Okay, on a much smaller Earth.
Yep.
So then, you know, this begs the question, you know, well, you know, how did the Earth get so big?
There's a lot of unanswered questions.
Right. And I had on my show a couple of months ago, Constantine Miles. He's an electrical engineering professor in Germany. And he's been doing some work in this area about the expanding Earth.
Yep.
Showing that it's related to neutrino emissions. You know, that neutrinos are interacting with the core of the Earth. Okay, because they notice that, well, there's less neutrinos at night than during the day. You know, that these neutrinos are being emitted from the sun. So that these neutrinos are being captured and are being converted. Okay? And Constantine has been working on this theory, you know, about this rate of expansion of the Earth. And he's been noticing that, I think within the last couple of decades here, that there's been an acceleration, you know, that the Earth is, there's a rapid acceleration of the expansion of the Earth going on.
That could, yeah. This is really a good case in point that I would like to just, I like Dr. Miles' work, and I really think he's on the right track on a lot of things. I personally would interpret neutrinos as probably differently than he would. Mm-hmm. But I can still appreciate where he's coming from and what he's trying to say. I would say that what we call neutrinos is perhaps something else. In other words, the effect is real. But, you know, whether there's a thing there that's called a neutrino, you know, that's another point to debate about.
The point I want to
make here is that this is the kind of conversations we have a lot is, you know, some people interpret their ideas in terms of neutrinos, other people interpret it in terms of something else, and they can be saying the same thing and yet have a totally different set of language to be talking about it. So that's, and we need to be open to that. I think that's the point I'm trying to get to.
Well, okay, Greg, but, you know, you have, you know, one of the presenters here, Kay Scarborough.
She's not a presenter. Her father, Alex Scarborough, she's just coming.
Okay, she's an
analytical... Not everybody there that's listed on the website.
An analytical chemist. And I see a couple of words here, expanding Earth and origin of hydrocarbon fuels.
Yep.
And I'm kind of putting the two together here that...
I would say so, yeah. In fact, one name that's pretty well known among the abiotic, what I call the abiotic oil theory,
right,
is Thomas Gold. And I think Thomas Gold is a unique individual. He's now deceased, but he was basically an emeritus professor who he didn't care what people thought of his work, and he just went ahead and said what he did and got away with it.
I like that.
He was a dissident at heart, but he remained, yes, you know, fully part of the mainstream community throughout his career. and very successful scientist. And by the way, I highly recommend his book, which the Deep Hot Biosphere. Mm-hmm. But actually, Gould's theories came out in the 1970s, and there was another man whose theories were coming out at the same time, and that was Alex Scarborough. His work has not been as well recognized, but some of the points that Gould has gotten received credit for, actually Scarborough preceded him, and for whatever that's worth, and at least independently came up with many of the same similar ideas. And yes, there is a connection let me quickly say that abiotic oil theory, which is gaining more acceptance, is the idea that oil is actually produced. In other words, the hydrogen and the oxygen and the carbon is already there underneath the earth, and it's separated out, and through certain chemical and I don't want to get into the details, but there are reactions that actually take place right now inside the earth that produce oil and produce water as also. And so we're getting new supplies of water and new supplies of oil that are being replenished from inside the earth.
Now, Greg, isn't that interesting?
Well, I think so.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's definitely evidence for it. The deeper you dig, of course, the more you're going to see it. There are Russian wells that are being dug off the coast of New Zealand or Australia. No, it's not China. Off the coast of Vietnam and that area, where they're going way down, seven miles into the crust, and they're finding new oil, virgin oil down there. And they're digging 20 miles deep.
You know what I think nobody has really done was measure gravity at those extreme depths. Do you know of any experiments where people have measured gravity at those, tremendous depths?
The only thing you could measure is the pressure, which obviously increases, but at some point the pressure would actually decrease, wouldn't it?
Well, if gravity was, of course, decreasing.
Well, no, I mean, as you go further in, this is...
Does gravity increase or decrease?
Sophomore physics, if you were in the center of the Earth, the pull is equal on all sides, so there is no pull, as it were, deep inside the Earth. But anyway, there's a whole lot of theories about what's going on inside the Earth. I guess my advice is to keep an open mind.
Yes, that's a very good question. What is the gravity at the center of the Earth? That is a very good question.
Well, I mean, the simplest answer would be assuming uniformity around on all four sides, of course, it would be equal, in all directions because the pole would be the same. Uh-huh. So, if you could put yourself in the center of the Earth, you would.
Well, Greg, Aurora Light wants to step in.
Okay.
Aurora?
Hello there. I've been listening, and I wanted to make a comment. Are you familiar with the experiments that were done in France about the gravitational pull, and when they found that they dropped, two weights, and in a very deep hole that was down for miles. You might be familiar with this experiment. I'm trying to pull it off the top of my head here. And when they noticed that the center of gravity was about 400 miles beneath the surface. And that because of the way they were pulled together, the weights, when they dropped them, the angle of them.
Yes, I heard something about that.
And that the crust of the Earth was 800 miles thick.
Uh-huh.
And that the center of the Earth.
Well, the Earth is hollow.
Is hollow.
Right.
And it's like a geode. Do you think that is possible that we have a hollow Earth, that it is formed like a geode?
As I said before, I try to keep an open mind. You're getting into areas that are not my area of expertise by any means, but there are a number of people who will be talking about things like that. Mm-hmm. Just to get back to the conference, the conference focuses on fundamental physics, and there's only a few papers who'll be talking about applications of that as it relates to the Earth and so on. But I have not heard of that experiment, and I'm open to some ideas. I think that's really the key thing, is if we can just keep an open mind. If we don't know, then just say we don't know. There's nothing wrong with that. And at this point, I don't think we do know really what's going on inside the center of the Earth. If I may, I'd like to just say a word or two about just kind of where I lean in terms of ideas about gravity. And I think your experiment, Bill, is really important, because you dropped two rocks, and one of them was magnetic and the
right.
other one wasn't.
Uh-huh.
Well, that was different rates.
Right,
yeah,
right. That was a replication of the Boyd-Bushman experiment.
Yes, I'm familiar with that, and I think that is extremely significant, because before we can talk about whether gravity is this or whether gravity is that, we have to ask an even more basic question. What is gravity?
Right.
And that's the question that, in my opinion, I refer to the work of Dr. Bill Lucas. And I think he's got the best answer out there. That's my opinion.
Uh-huh. Now, is he going to be at the conference? Or?
No, he's not, but he has contributed in the past, and he will be there next year. He's on the East Coast and is not able to make it this week.
Ah, okay.
But anyway, Dr. Lucas's idea is basically this, that the force of gravity is a small residual attraction that arises from a not quite canceling repulsion and attraction between electrical dipoles. Now, let me explain. Electrical dipole is real simple. You got a positive element and a negative one. So it could be a proton and electron. And we know that that's how atoms are formed. I mean, they have a proton core and a positive core and a negative.
Mm-hmm.
Outer core. That's a dipole, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we get is when we get two dipoles that are far enough apart, okay, we're going to get an attraction through the opposite. In other words, the proton of one and the electron of the other are going to cause an attraction, but the proton of one and the proton of the other and the electron of one and the electron of the other are going to cause a repulsion.
Mm-hmm.
And if you add up that attraction and repulsion, what you can get, according to Lucas, is a small, tiny imbalance in favor of the attraction.
Mm-hmm.
He says that's what gravity is. And in my opinion, that's the best explanation that's out there right now.
Mm-hmm.
So,
now, do you think there might be a relation to the strong force in there?
Absolutely. And in fact, in the Lucas model, you know, there is no such thing as a strong force or a weak force.
Uh-huh.
There's just electrodynamics, and it is able to explain things. The problem is, When we look at things at different levels, we see, we see the same force acting in a different way, and it seems like a different force.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the Bergman-Lucas model, what you have are rings of matter that circulate, and they circulate because that's the only way motion ultimately can. That's all that it can do is follow circuits.
Mm-hmm.
And because it follows circuits, it has a magnetic field, and these magnetic fields are creating attractive forces. Think of it this way. I like to describe Ampere's law this way. If you have water flowing through a pipe,
yes,
and you reduce the cross section of that pipe, what happens to the flow velocity?
Increases.
It increases. The reason is you have to have the same amount of matter passing through each cross section, because
mm-hmm.
matter isn't created or destroyed. You follow that? That's basically what Ampere's law says.
Mm-hmm.
It says that when you have more matter, the reverse is also true. When you increase the flow velocity, you decrease the cross section of the flow.
Mm-hmm.
So you see that when a water flows down a waterfall, you see it actually kind of coming together as it gets toward the bottom and actually starting to swirl a little bit, and that's another issue. But
mm-hmm.
you follow, or you can see it just falling
oh, yeah.
out of your sink. The channel actually gets smaller because the gravity
mm-hmm.
is pulling it down. It moves faster. The same amount of matter has to pass through each cross section, so it attracts. And believe it or not, that's the source of attraction of this electrical model.
Mm-hmm.
It's just common sense. When something moves faster, when it moves at the speed we call c, okay,
right.
When it moves at that speed, it's attract that's the cause of the attraction is the motion. This is what Tesla said too. He said that it is a dynamic. The attraction is due to the dynamics, not due to anything static. You don't get attraction just by things just sitting there in a lump, which is basically the concept of mass. That's a misconception. The attraction comes from the motion. And it comes from that very simple principle. If we can get that in our heads, we can understand how this all comes about. And
mm-hmm.
so anyway, according to the Bergman-Lucas model, this is how things get a stable configuration in the first place. And
mm-hmm.
this is how we can have stable particles that have structure to them, that have actual, you know, geometry. And they're not just point particles, which is, believe it or not, that's what mainstream physics believes, that because of Heisenberg, they believe that you cannot get below, you know, a certain quantum level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's baloney. You can. You can understand it. Now, there are certain things we can't measure. There are limitations on what we can measure because everything, every you know, tool of measurement is going to interfere with the thing it's measuring. There's no argument there. But the question is, can we come up with physical models that explain what these things really are doing? Yes, we can. And there are quite a few people at the conference who will be doing just that. So, anyway.
Well, Greg, did you know that the original proposal of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle had to do with how the mind affected these experiments, you know, at the quantum level?
I believe I have heard that, yeah.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And that's certainly true, because when your mind is working, there's something physical going on there, and mm-hmm. absolutely it's interacting with the things around it. So I have no problem with that. The problem is, you know, do we have to say, can we, you know, it's impossible to model these things because of that principle? That's crazy. I mean, why? I don't see any reason why we should, you know, say, okay, we won't give up. So, but basically, that's the mainstream attitude today.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it's not possible. It's a waste of time to try to model these things, because they're not modelable. They're just point particles. And how can something that's a point have a magnetic moment? I mean, a magnetic moment implies that there's a circuit. A current that's flowing in a circuit. So why not just say that's what they are?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's correct.
Well, you know, the listener out there, we have a call-in number. Our phone number is 928-202-4274. If you have a question for Greg, you can call that number. Again, the number is 928-202-4274. And so, Greg, you know, this really looks like an exciting conference. I mean, personally, I'm looking forward to it.
Cool.
Yes, and Aurora, well, Aurora wants to talk to you about it, too. You
know, okay, go ahead.
I'm looking forward to doing some interviews with some of your guest speakers.
Laura?
Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I said yes, I'm looking forward to attending as well. And I'm looking forward to Bill's interviewing a number of your guest speakers, and you know, it's very exciting that people like yourself are taking an interest in technology and helping to steer our planet in the right direction. I feel like the suppression has been on for so long, and what's your feelings on that? Do you think that we're going to be able to break through the cartels' stranglehold that they've had on technology for so long?
You know, my approach is a little different, and I really have a lot of respect for the guys over the decades who have come up with technologies, and you know, then you know, for whatever reason they got lost or buried or whatever. My attitude is a little different. I am not attempting to develop a new widget and then, you know, make millions of dollars from my widget. Although I know, and I have no qualms with anybody who has that attitude, my attitude is different. And that is, what I want and what I think is going to be of the most benefit is if we can have scientific ideas that develop testable hypotheses, and then we go out and test them. And then we take test results, and what I really think is lacking today, Bill Beattie made a speech, and he basically said this. He said, there's a lot of people out there that are putzing around with technology, and that's fine. But that's not what's needed. What's needed are actual physical objective experiments that are measuring certain quantities. So we take an experiment, we run it this way, and then we run the exact same experiment, except we change this variable. And here's the measured results. That's something that a scientist can take and say, okay, here's my theory to explain this. But when we just kind of say, well, here's this motor and it does this cool stuff, it's like, boy, how do you develop a theory around that? You got to have quantified, reproducible, published results. So that's my call to anybody who's out there technically inclined. We have a number of experiments that we need to get done. Some of them are optically related, some of them related to gravitational effects, different things. But we need competent technical people to carry them out and to make them quantifiable, publishable, and reproducible. And that's not something anybody's going to give you lots of money to do, but, you know, that's what Michael Faraday did. That's what Ampere did. You know, that's what we need more than anything else, in my opinion. So we're trying to promote that with this public day because, on the one hand, the one error is to just get all wrapped up in your theory and then never go out and do anything with it, and, and that's one extreme. And the other extreme is to just putz around with your stuff and never, you know, and just hope that you're going to build a machine that powers the world. Well, we gotta bridge that gap somewhere in between. And my desire is just to understand nature better, and I think that we can do that. And by the way, history has always shown that the really innovative ideas come from outside mainstream. And so, if that's where you want to be, then come to the Long Beach Conference.
Well, you know, that's where I think the real breakthroughs come from. You know, are these garage shop inventors. And then, of course, it, you know, it finds its way eventually into mainstream science. But it's a tough road to hoe, I'll tell you that.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely.
You know, and the funding, it's very difficult to get funding for this stuff.
Yeah. What I was going to mention the recipients of the Sagnac Award, and I, you know, we've gone back and forth, and I've exchanged a lot of emails with a lot of people, and we're convinced that really there is funding available for the kind of work that I'm talking about. There are people who are willing to fund just pure scientific research, and so seriously, that's my challenge. If there's somebody out there who says, you know, I'm ready to go, and for example, let's take Ken Shoulders. Ken Shoulders, you know, you're familiar with his work?
Oh, yeah.
He's been doing these exotic vacuum objects. He's been doing them for nearly 20 years now. And guess what? Not one person has reproduced his work. That is a crime. Why isn't there somebody out there, you know, he's even willing to help somebody to do it. And I've talked to him personally, and he would do that. But, you know, we got to have somebody seriously interested in reproducing that work, you know, to be done. And it can be done at basically somebody who's willing to invest the time. I guarantee we can get the resources. So it's not a question of money. It's a question of can we find somebody who's seriously going to put in the time to do this? And you know, you're not going to get paid because you're not going to get funding. It's not mainstream. Sorry,
it's a work of love, I think. You know,
yeah, but this is my point. That's one example, and I can give you 10 more of things like that that really need to be done. Dr. Tom Phipps, who's going to be one of our recipients, he's probably written close to 100 articles in what I call non-mainstream periodicals. He has been preaching the Hertzian dynamics. I alluded to it earlier, the idea of total time derivatives. But he has a second order, what we call, this is an effect that's been known. Stellar aberration has been known since the 1600s. It's basically the fact that we see stars in a slightly different position based on the fact that the Earth is moving around the sun. And Einsteinian theory agrees with the first order prediction, but there is a second order number which would require more accurate measurements of that, which he's predicting. It's a measurable difference. Trouble is, he's been trying to get that experiment performed for 20, 30 years, and you know, if we could find somebody that would say, hey, I'll do it, we could get the funding. We could get all the equipment. That's not the problem. We just got to get somebody that has a passion to see that happen. So anyway, I won't give you more examples, but there are plenty. So, and this is why we feel the need to try to get the two worlds together at this conference. And hopefully this public day will be a chance to maybe make that happen a little bit.
You know, Greg, I had a guest on my show here several weeks ago, I think it was March 27th, his name is Thane Hines. And he works, he's a technician at a university up there in Canada. And he was able to use their lab, and he built this machine. And his machine is a, I don't know how else to put it. You know, it's he calls it a regenerative acceleration effect, where he uses a combination motor generator. And what he was able to do is set up a special coil such that it cancels out the Lenz's law effect okay, and in magnetism. And when he does that, he's able to utilize excess energy from this device. And he took this machine and demonstrated it at MIT. And when one of the professors there, you know, was looking at it, you know, this is an amazing machine, you know, puts out excess energy, several 100% excess energy, you know, and they're measuring this. But right. As soon as one of the professors brought up the word perpetual motion, they all walked out. You know, they just, you know, it's just not, you know, acceptable. You know, as soon as perpetual motion, the words come up, you know, they just walk right out.
Yep.
You know, so here's a machine that, to me, clearly demonstrates perpetual motion, okay,
yep.
if you utilize it correctly. And, an incredible invention here, I think. And, you know, he doesn't get the time of day.
I know. It's, you know, all I can say is it's a tough road. You know that.
I'll tell you, Greg. Right now,
let's get more people doing it.
See, right now, I'm trying to do something about that. Okay, you know that problem. And I noticed that you have John Maluski coming to your conference.
Yes.
And John has done some very intriguing work. Okay, with this Ormi Gold, you know, and microwaving, and that's what I'm pursuing. You know, this gold reclamation project.
Yeah. I'm very happy to have him there because, as I see it, he's kind of in both worlds. And I we need to get more people that are like that. Mm-hmm. So, and you too. I mean, you're that's what we need is, you know, because I'll be honest, there are, and this is something we all have to live with. There are people in the, what I might call the new energy community, which you're at home with,
mm-hmm.
who really don't have the time of day, as it were, for those crazy people who say that Einstein's wrong. And there are a few, I won't name names, but there are people that have that attitude, and there are also people in the you know, the Einstein's wrong, you know, or Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics.
Well, I think he got part of
it right. That say, well, those new energy people, they're just a bunch of kooks. My point is, hey, let's all, you know, let's take some time to listen to each other because, you know, maybe we can learn from each other because there's a whole lot of things here we don't understand. Let's have an open mind and, you know, you can certainly have your opinion and you can mm-hmm. voice that, but that, you know, we need to develop an environment where we can agree to disagree and,
right.
And learn from each other in spite of that. And, that's what we're trying to foster and hopefully, And the other thing that we're trying to do, we really want to make an open door as wide as we can to students in physics and engineering.
Yes.
That's what we're really targeting to come to this conference. They can come and they can, you know, kick tires and they can even come with an attitude. It doesn't matter. As long
I noticed you invited Chris Ekman.
Yes. Chris is wonderful.
And he's done some intriguing work with Brown's gas.
Absolutely. He may be, you know, one of the world's authorities on Brown's gas at this point,
mm-hmm.
which is saying a lot. There's a number of people who've been coming up with theoretical ideas. But what I like about Chris is he's doing the experimental work right alongside the theoretical work. And, boy, we need more of that.
Oh, yeah.
So,
well, he's
so,
a young
And he's quantifying
young
his stuff. He's not just saying, you know, this is really neat. He's saying, here's the numbers, you know, and that's great.
Mm-hmm. Well, he I think he got a little bit of backing from his university that he's attending.
Yes, Chris is lucky. He's one of the very few people on Earth right now, at least in the United States,
mm-hmm.
who are actually receiving funding to do research, you know, in a more controversial topic. But
can I ask you a question?
With an advisor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Aurora has a question.
Yes,
right,
I'd like to know, since, you know, the Obama administration seems to be promoting, you know, the a green trip, are things opening up a little bit here at the universities for experimentation?
Not that I am aware of, but, you know, I only know, you know, our little universe, so I don't pretend to have knowledge of everything.
Yeah, we're
I
not
know
seeing
Chris has been
much
lucky,
assistance from the government.
But I haven't, you know, we're not seeing any money coming our way.
Right.
So.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's supposed to be a lot of grant money out there right now. So
okay.
I was wondering why, you know, don't you think a lot of these experimenters, inventors, you know, engineer types could be applying for that right now with the way our country seems to want some alternatives
now.
Well, there's nothing I would like more than to see, you know, a bunch of graduate students see some of the ideas. One of the things we're still working on with the database, which is worldsci.org, is we're in
what is it again? Could you repeat yourself?
Sorry, worldsci.org. That's the database, which is sort of the conference is an event. It'll be over eventually, but the database will live on. And the two are connected mm-hmm. because the same people that are in the database are the ones who are going to be participating in the conference mm-hmm. for the most part. So, but what I'm – now I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. One of the things we want to do in the database is create a database of experimental proposals. And we're doing that. Mm-hmm. It's very rough and not what it should be at this point. But we want to have them and say, there it is, you know, and here's the specifications. Here's what you need to get it done. You know, and again, the money is usually not the biggest issue. The biggest issue is finding, like you said, a graduate student, you know, who not only is interested in doing it, but he can actually get paid, you know, a salary, something to get him to do that. And he can find a professor who's willing to say, okay, let's go ahead and try this crazy stuff. You know, the reason why some of these experiments aren't getting done is because we think, you know, again, we think we already have the answer. So, and that's the surest road to ignorance. Mm-hmm. Belief that you already have the answer. So,
well, you know, we touched on this grant funding, and mm-hmm. you know, I went through some of my through some of that myself, you know, trying to apply for some of these grants. And what you have to have is a professional grant writer.
Yes.
Okay. Can put together this whole. It's a horrendous task. Okay, writing a grant, you know, or applying for these grants, because they make you jump through all these hoops.
Right. And
we jump through them to get our 501c3. I'm sure we can jump
exactly.
through a few more.
Well, that's where you come along.
Exactly.
And you pay a professional grant writer to do that.
Yep. I seriously think the number one need, though, is to find, you know, again, a young graduate student says, I want to do that. You know, I'd like to do that project. We will bend over backwards to, you know, help somebody. You know, we'll even find a grant writer. I mean, those things can be done if it's just money.
Okay, go find us a grant writer. We're ready.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll have to talk later.
Greg.
But
Go get us a grant writer.
We have a specific proposal, you know, for a specific thing that is of some scientific value. I think that can be done. It's just mm-hmm. really finding the person who's...
Bill wants to get on with his anti-gravity free energy spacecraft here.
Yes.
And, you know, revolutionize the technology industry. So, you know, we're just waiting on a grant writer. So any of you grant writers out there, give us a call. And if you want to get us one, like you said, you're interested in assisting people
Great.
Who have projects that are worthy of your attention.
Well, I would say this. Let's sit down and write a serious proposal. You know, here's what we need. Here's what the money is going to be used for, and here's the equipment that we need, and here's what we hope to measure. The goal would be to have something that was publishable. Whether it actually gets published in a mainstream periodical or not is secondary. If it's of that quality that we could publish it in next year's proceedings, for example.
Well, what Bill and I'd like to put together is the Progressive Technology Center. That is kind of a welcoming center, museum-type place where people will come in and be able to see what's going on in technology right here and now and, you know, be more of a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
We have people who, you know, they don't know how to get involved in this end of things. Like, your conference is a great place for people to start.
And, Greg, we only have a couple of minutes left here.
Okay.
So the floor is yours here.
Well, I'll just put in a couple more plugs, and that is, please, if you're nobody called in, so I don't know how many people are listening, but if you do...
Oh, there's quite a few people.
If you happen to be anywhere on the West Coast, please consider attending the conference. I don't think I told you that it was.
Well, people will come in from around the world, actually. We've had that happen many times.
All right. Well, the conference will be held from June 23rd to June 26th in Long Beach, California, at the Long Beach, UC Long Beach. And
at what hotel?
I'm sorry?
We didn't hear it.
Okay, let me say that again. It's the 17th annual conference of the Natural Philosophy Alliance. It's going to be held at the University of California, Long Beach, from June 23rd to June 26th. That's a Wednesday through a Saturday. We're going to have Saturday specifically open to the public. That's the day when we're going to be in the pyramid on Long Beach campus, and we're going to be demonstrating some of our toys and our models and having
in
some,
the pyramid.
The pyramid is the big. It's the big building on the Long Beach campus. It's beautiful.
Oh.
If you take a look at the website, you'll see a picture of it. Pretty neat. pretty neat building.
Awesome.
We're going to have a lot of really interesting speakers there and some interesting models on Saturday. If you can make the entire conference, fabulous. Please let us know. Go ahead and sign up.
Do you have hotels with special prices for your attendees?
Do we have special prices? I mean, there's a conference registration. It's relatively inexpensive. I believe it's, I don't even know off the top of my head. I think it's $55. We do ask that you become a member, so that's $85, $30 for the membership of the NPA if you want to attend the entire conference. If you just want to come public day, you don't have to worry about that.
No, I was just asking you about your hotels, if you had any hotels you were working with.
Oh, okay, yeah, I'm sorry. Well, there's details on there. A lot of people, believe it or not, are staying in the dorms. That's what I'm going to do.
Staying at the dorm. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, we've done that for lots of conferences.
Yeah,
yeah,
$60 a day gets
you
room and
board. Dorm rooms.
So.
Mm-hmm. And there's a cafeteria there then.
Yep, and it's pretty close by, so we'll be there. And it's pretty intense. We're going to have, it'll be going all day long and into the evening,
right.
3 days, and also Saturday. So you're going to be.
Is there a Starbucks there?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
It's a private joke. Don't answer. Don't answer. We're doing battle over Starbucks on a daily basis.
Anyway, well, I just wanted to repeat the website, if I could, and that is conf17.worldsci, that's worldsci.org. That's the conference website. The database website is the same thing. Just throw out the CONF17.
Well, not to worry. It'll all be up on the Internet here for you. Your show will be archived. People will be listening to it from here on out. And we get thousands of people coming into our website, checking it out, and listening to the shows that are archived. And thank you so much for being
yes,
with us.
Yes, thank you, Greg. And
thank you, Bill. I appreciate it very much.
Great.
We look forward to seeing you in L.A. and look forward to seeing all of you out there.
Oh, yes.
At the conference.
Very exciting.
So let's make it happen. Your prices are fantastic. I'm very impressed that you're making it so available to people. So take advantage of the availability that Greg has offered with this fantastic conference, and we'll be seeing you there.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Greg. And coming up next is Michael Elajan and his cutting-edge contacts with cosmic beings. That's next on Vortex Network News. Have a great day, everyone.